If you close your eyes and think about the personalities of the 60s, a flood of faces and voices should cross your mind, and probably a flood, however muted, of emotion. If it was nothing else, it was tumultuous. As someone has said, the 60s will never level out in our minds. It was a good time, and a woefully bad time, but it was never indifferent. And the personalities? Nothing indifferent about them, either. Among those that might have crossed your mind by now, a man known as the High Priest, Dr. Timothy Leary. If you can't remember his coined phrase that echoed from one end of the nation to the other, you probably weren't there. From KUAC FM in Fairbanks, I'm Susan McGinnis, and this is Conversations. For the next hour, a conversation with Dr. Timothy Leary. Dr. Leary, thanks for joining us today.
I'm having a great time in Fairbanks. It's my first trip to the North Pole, and I love it.
I'm glad to know it. The 60s, some have said, lifted a lid on the pressure cooker of conformity, I guess, that was the 50s. The Cold War, segregation. It also loosed a generation to experiment in all sorts of ways, sexually, politically, spiritually, socially. It was a very good time in those ways. And in some ways, like I mentioned in my lead, it was very bad. We lost some of the nation's heroes during that time. We lost 50,000 young men in a war called Vietnam. And we lost a good many people in riots in the cities. I'm wondering what your gauge is.
And we lost leaders like Bobby Kennedy, Kennedy, Martin Luther King. I could go on.
Yeah. What's your your gauge looking back from the 90s? Is the 60s a significant time from your perspective looking back from now?
Well, I must say the 90s are not dull. More has happened in the last 18 months than really happened in decades in the past. I don't isolate the 60s from the mainstream of history. Each step, each decade is kind of a step in a evolution of society and culture in America. So the 60s did come after the Eisenhower uptight materialistic 50s. I must say, though, that what happened in the 60s, which was a explosion of individuality and of humanistic thought and of irreverence to authority and questioning religion and political establishments, that's nothing new. It's happened many, many times in human history. Every time an empire or a civilization gets too uptight, too controlling, yes, there's a pressure cooker. That's a good metaphor. The explosions of humanism in the past have been called Renaissance. Mm-hmm. It happened in Greece with Socrates and Plato. Amazing at that time when the Persian and Iranian and Iraqi empires were fighting in Baghdad and Persia. In the coasts of Greece, these little peninsulas separated and protected from the big armies, the Greek theory of individuality. Socrates said, "Know thyself." And Plato said the ultimate virtue is intelligence, and the purpose of human life is to go within and discover and help other people do it. So that was like the 60s. The Renaissance in Europe was the same way. A glorification of the individual, self-expression. Always, of course, humanism involves sexual freedom, the wonderful paintings and sculptures of Greece in the Alexandrian period and in the Renaissance with Michelangelo. So this is part of the rhythm, almost the contraction, expansion of human evolution. So the 60s were certainly that.
Where do you think it's left us in the 90s or 70s and 80s, because we can look back better on that period? Are we closing back in or continuing to open out, do you think?
Well, who do you mean by we, white woman? I'm very, very sensitive to the plural pronoun we these days. People say, do you think we should nuke, I don't know, someone? Count me out. the 60s set off a wave of individuality that was stopped in America in 1980 when Nancy Reagan was elected president. But it didn't leave America. It left America, but it went to Europe. The spirit of irreverence, of questioning authority, peaked in Europe in the 70s in Spain, and in Germany. It peaked in the 80s with the fall of the Berlin Wall. The wonderful symbol of the late 80s was that young 19-year-old boy. Mm-hmm. His name was Wim Wyland, who stood in front of 13 tanks. In his left hand, he had his school book bag, and his right hand, he had his lunch bag. What a wonderful, wonderful example of 60s spirit. Another thing about the 60s, which made it very, the 60s spirit made it powerful, was this the first time that this self-expression and individuality could be sent around the world in the form of electronic information. You had, before, it might take months or years before the Socratic dialogue issue, you know, would hit someplace else with the sailboats. But the rock and rollers and Dylan singing "Ain't Gonna Work in Maggie's Farm No More," it swept the world. Handheld record tape machines. So the 60s didn't stop. It percolated around the world, and the young people that overthrew communism were very aware of the fact that there was a generation of young people in this country that said to the most powerful empire in the world, "Hell no, we won't go. We won't go 9,000 miles to fight a war against third world countries that do not threaten us." So the 60s, one thing we learned about evolution is that everything evolves and mutates and changes. But the spirit of the 60s, of irreverence to authority and self-expression, that's what America's all about. That's Tom Jefferson, that's Benjamin Franklin, it's those people in Boston Harbor that threw the tea into the harbor and said, "Hell no, George III, we're not going to put up with your stuff anymore." So to me, the 60s is mainline Americanism. It's Huckleberry Finn and Mark Twain going down the river with the worst crime they could have committed, freeing a slave. It's Ralph Waldo Emerson, you know, getting banned from Harvard for saying God is within, not in the churches. So I believe that we in the 60s who rode that wave are part of the basic American tradition, and it's the glory and hope of American idealism to stand up and, even though you're right or wrong, you know, speak out.
You're listening to Dr. Timothy Leary. This is Conversations on KUAC-FM. Dr. Leary took his bachelor's from the University of Alabama in 1943, his master's from Washington State in 1946, and his PhD from UC Berkeley in 1950. He has spent his life in the interest of the advancement of psychology and the evolution of human potential. I'm Susan McInnes.
That's right. I'd like to pick up that last thing. My life has been dedicated to the Socratic ideal, empowerment of the individual. Think for yourself, question authority. That's the theme that's gone down through the centuries, and every dictator and authoritarian religious leader hates it, but that's the basic thing, empowerment of the individual.
You said in your autobiography called Flashbacks, you said that the idea that radical thinkers are dangerous is terribly important in the evolution of society. Wilhelm Reich, for example, with his thinking in our own time, ended up in jail with his books burned. Ralph Waldo Emerson was taken off the faculty at Harvard for his ideas.
Galileo was hauled down to Rome and made to recant. He had to say the world is not round. Bruno, who said pretty much the same thing that I've been saying, questioning authority, they burned him at the stake. They microwaved Bruno for saying pretty much what I'm saying, so that's an old tradition. And I was never offended when the authoritarian guys that are running America, like Richard Nixon, call me the most dangerous man alive. Well, I was dangerous to him and what he believed, but mm-hmm. I'm a very like my models and ideals, I'm a very nonviolent person. I believe in ideas and the power of the human mind to be put on fire with a new idea.
You said that if you're not in trouble with society, you're not doing your job. What has that meant in your life? What job have you done that has brought you continually in trouble with society?
Well, I encourage and I empower individuals to think for themselves. In the 1950s, I was one of a group of psychologists coming after World War II that wrenched the power to change the mind away from psychiatry and the establishment and gave it to the individual. I was the first person to do a doctorate of research on group therapy, which was very radical. The idea that patients could sit around in a group and discuss each other's symptoms.
They said it destroyed the theory of confidentiality.
Worse than that, it was immoral and illegal. It was practicing medicine without a license. You wouldn't have a group of surgical patients sitting around cutting each other up with the scalpels, not to mention the contamination of one mind with the neurosis of another. But we did empower now the idea, everyone knows that if you have a problem, you don't go to some almighty doctor who's going to solve it. You go to a group with other people that have that problem, and you learn together. And you share, and you pick up tips, and you, without the almighty doctor there telling you what to do. In the 60s, I was part of a large group of scientists and scholars and artists and poets and your basic revolutionaries who took the power of activating the brain with drugs away from the medical people. I'm not talking about the word drug today. Mm. I'm not talking about the drugs of the Reagan-Bush administration, alcohol, steroids, crack, booze, that sort of thing. We're talking about the consciousness expansion drugs, and that was a great threat. Today in the 90s, in the 80s and the 90s, I've been obsessively involved in developing low-cost, inexpensive computers that will allow young people to communicate and mind telephones and taking the power of the screen away from NBC, ABC, and the CIA and giving it to the individual who can change what's on the screen. I tell you, well, I'll pause there and let you pick up.
I'm interested in something about psychology and psychiatry. The first thing you mentioned after my question, you left Kaiser Hospital Foundation in Oakland in 1959, enduring a crisis of career. You, with your peers, had discovered that a third of the patients were getting better, a third of the patients were getting worse, and a third of the patients were seeing no change at all under psychological and psychiatric work at that time. Yep. Has the influence of Bill, the founder of Alcoholics Anonymous, of your own transactional analysis that was popularized by Eric Byrne, and group therapy changed psychology and psychiatry in the 80s and 90s? Has it advanced, or is it still stuck from your perspective?
Oh, there's irrefutable evidence that the average American now knows that you can't go to a doctor to solve your problem. I just did a test, and by the way, I encourage anyone to check this out. Get the phone book of any big American city and look in the yellow pages for psychiatry. And in the Los Angeles, West Los Angeles yellow pages, there's about one column of medical psychiatrists. Now look up self-help.
Pages,
you get massage,
right?
Drug counseling, you get social work, you get marriage counseling, you get a consciousness-raising group. You can't think of a problem that there isn't 30 or 40 groups and specialists to help you do something yourself. According to my statistics, back in the 1950s, there was no such thing as counseling and self-help. I'd say that now the ratio is about, for every psychiatrist wants to put you on a couch, there are probably 100 in the phone book, 100 offices or groups that will help you help yourself.
And that is, part of the impact there is that the that the client, if I come to you for help, you put me in the position of driving the car. You make me responsible for my own therapy and my own expansion. Is that accurate?
But I put you in a group because the human being basically, and when I talk about empowering the individual, I don't want to empower the individual to go around being self-indulgent and grabbing and, you know, just thinking about one person yourself. The individual human being operates best in a small group. We're basically pack tribal animals. We're not supposed to be living alone. On the other hand, we're not insects. We're not supposed to live in big hives with thousands of other anonymous warrior bees or worker ants and that sort of thing. During the industrial age, it was necessary for 200 or 300 years for us to go through an insectoid hive sort of thing, the factory civilization, where you're born in a factory hospital and you go to a factory school and you are trained to be a cog and a robot in the big factory system. That's over now, and it's causing a lot of grief and confusion in American society that it's over. The human being is basically designed to live, to work with small groups, not live, and belong to many different groups. And the work I'm doing with computers now, we're setting up computer networks of small groups so that you can be, if you're studying Huckleberry Finn, you might be doing it with a student in Tennessee and a student in Japan and a student in Rome. We're using the computers to help people, as I say, like mind phones, to get into small groups to communicate. The first step in this direction, as I'm sure all of your listeners know, is electronic bulletin boards. Right here in the Fairbanks, there are probably over 100. People have computers and make a local phone call, and suddenly you're talking to someone in San Francisco or Japan.
How does this extend the human potential movement in your mind?
Well, it breaks down the barriers of religion and geography and language. You're getting to know the world. You're getting to exchange. The human brain has to have someone to bounce it back. It doesn't do any good to sit and think and write by yourself or play with a computer by yourself. The human brain is an interactive organ, and this basic quantum physics I'm talking about the humanization and the personalization of quantum physics, that the energy exists in a field, and you've got to have other people to exchange ideas with. And for those of you that are listening to me right now, the aim of what I'm doing is to try to infiltrate your mind with some shocking ideas and new ideas that you'll then discuss with other people. And I wish we could have phone-ins so that you could be arguing with me and questioning my authority, because I'm like you. I'm just trying to develop myself and grow.
Go back with me to your introduction to psychedelic drugs. These drugs, you believed after some experimentation, would begin to open windows in the mind. Your thinking at the time was that who are you, white woman, that human beings are limited, are shut down by our social conditioning, and that certain psychedelic drugs helped the individual open that window to a broader perspective, to more realities. How does that work psychologically?
Well, let me just comment on the question. Number one, you use the word drugs, and of course, I have to be clear. We're talking about botanical plants that for thousands and thousands of years have been used by human beings, not for food, not for bodily sustenance, but for alteration of the brain, for expanding consciousness. So this is nothing new, and I didn't come out with the idea that that psychedelic plants and vegetables like marijuana, LSD, and especially the mushrooms, peyote, I didn't invent the idea that these substances could be used to expand the mind. Now, the second thing you said was they would open windows. Now, you're using a metaphor there that was used by Aldous Huxley when he used this concept, the doors to perception. He was quoting William Blake, that you could clean the windows of perception and look within your mind. This was picked up, by the way, by Jim Morrison, the Doors, the famous rock group from the 60s. that's the name for Huxley, the doors of perception are now clean. The metaphor of a window looking into the mind was good back in the days of Blake, or even in the days of Jim Morrison. But today we use a different metaphor. We use the idea of the biocomputer, and that what these substances do is allow you to boot up or activate the circuits in your brain. That's actually neurotransmitters opening up receptor sites in the brain that turn on new circuits and allow you to reprogram and reformat your mind. I'll pause here and let you pick up. Shall I go on?
No, that's all right. I was trying to find something in our reality which can connect to those new receptors for people who've never taken psychedelic drugs and who are not sure what you're saying when you talk about connecting up with new receptors. Is there anything in our reality that explains that?
Yes. One of the interesting things that has happened is since we first did our research at Harvard using psychedelic plants, mainly the mushrooms then, we realized there was no language to express the inundation of colors and multimedia fireworks in the brain and the fast-moving scenarios and the sensory overload that comes when you activate and boot up your brain. Words can't describe it. So we started experimenting with using lights, and we would have screens with biological processes, and then we'd overload that with the slides, and then we would pop in faces of people. In 1963-64, we presented these in New York, and it swept the world. If you want to know what psychedelic experience is, get some black and white television from the year 1963 and watch it. And then watch the commercials on the Super Bowl right now, and you'll see the difference. The average television watcher today is inundated by psychedelic imagery of fast-moving, changing, sweeping, computer-generated sensory overload, boom, boom, boom.
So it is to the television of 63.
The light belongs to Nick Michelob. Wow.
It is to the television of 63 as to the television of 90.
Yeah.
It is to say straight reality versus psychedelic experience.
Yeah. It's not just television. I'm fascinated with... I'm basically a mathematical psychologist. I keep score. And I estimate now that the average American is exposed to electronic information at about 100 times more than we were in 1960. Let me use myself as an example. In 1960, I was a Harvard professor, a nice house. I was a psychologist. I was interested in information. I had one black and white television set and two telephones with these rotary dials, mm-hmm. Period. My 17-year-old son now, who is an average high school kid, he works weekends and sometimes nights. He is, because most of the kids have to these days. And he, with a little help from us, he's just an average kid. He has in his room about 100 times more powerful electronic devices. He's got an answering machine. He's got a Walkman. He's got a compact disc. He's got, he doesn't have a fax machine, I do. He's got a modem. The human brain likes that. The human brain, I've done a lot of conversations with my brain, and she tells me what she wants. She wants to be inundated. My brain is bored luggering along at, talking words the way I am now. My brain wants to be stimulated and flooded with electronic information. My brain wants to get in touch with others that way. So the psychedelic experience was just part of the acceleration and intensification of the human nervous system, human communication, which you can't believe. Well, try the experiment. Go back and imagine yourself watching 1960s television, then watch MTV for for an hour, and you'll see the difference. The wonderful thing in Tiananmen Square, when that young Chinese boy we spoke of, that young people's revolution in China was fax machines and telephones, mm-hmm. and getting the word around, so that the Berlin Wall came down because the example of that young man in China was seen on televisions in all through the communist countries. The word got out.
Once again, you're listening to Dr. Timothy Leary. A minute ago, you referred to your brain as she. Is your brain a female receptive vessel from your perspective?
Well, I'm just messing around with people's brains here.
Okay.
I like to... we've lived in such a incredibly male macho society here. That God, he, and mankind, and all that shit. I mean, really. So I like to shock, uptight people by I often refer to the word God as she. Of course, that's just to make you think. By the way, this is a commercial break, an announcement from Timothy Laird. Don't believe anything I'm saying here. I'm just going to send you messages to get you thinking and arguing with me. It's my job to irritate you a little bit and to shock you and confuse you. I am confused. I don't have any answers, but I think I'm focused on the right issues here, which is increase your intelligence. And
in the 60s, you talked about imprinting. You did experiments with convicts in hospitals around Cambridge.
Prisons.
I said hospitals. I'm sorry. I meant prisons. And discovered that giving them psychedelic drugs, they became much more open to experience, much less likely to break laws, much less likely to go back to prison. You talked about it in terms of...
Well, we didn't give them drugs. We went into the prison. We explained what we were doing. We said we didn't know exactly, but that we were doing it ourselves. And every time we had a psychedelic drug session in the hospital, at least one or two of the Harvard people did it with them. So we weren't doing anything to them that we weren't doing ourselves. And we were sharing that experience with them. And the results show that, they saw through the... the cops and robbers game, and we cut the crime rate, the recidivism rate, from about 70% to about 10% for the 3 years we ran that project.
I also understand after that project was done, was cut off, the prisoners themselves, the ex-cons, formed support groups for themselves to keep themselves out of prison.
That was a help with some Harvard psychologists. The support group went on long after the drug experiment was stopped by the government.
When you discussed those prisoners in your book, Flashbacks, you talked about imprinting and re-imprinting, which is the thing I would like you to discuss now, that psychedelic drugs can suspend previous imprints of reality, inducing what you called a critical period where new imprints could be made. What do you mean?
Well, it's not just drugs that do this. If you know how to stimulate the brain and get the brain into a hypnotic state, CNN News right now is brainwashing people. It's incredible. You get that swirling logo of CNN and vroom, vroom, different colors, and then you have a shot of the sunset. There you have five poor American troops walking like camels, carrying guns, and then suddenly, whack, there's President Bush telling you... we're going to win. Happy news. We're going to win. Happy news. That's using, that's activating and booting up the brain and getting the brain vulnerable. The brain can be programmed by anyone skillful enough. By the way, I must tell you something. Brainwashing and the use of psychedelic experiences to get, to imprint messages has been used for centuries by religious leaders. Those bozos knew exactly what they were doing. They built these enormous cathedrals with the big rose windows, and you'd come there, and the architect would take you up, and there's a picture of the Tooth Fairy or Bruce Christ, where he is, and the organ music and the incense, and suddenly they're telling you, God is the Lord, to bow down, kneel down. My, those fellows. I give them credit. Boy, they knew how to run a session. Hitler was a master in, getting thousands, hundreds of thousands of people together and using. Hitler was the first person to use electronics, radio. Boy, he would hypnotize. Mussolini, they all shout, Duce, Duce. The authoritarian people have always known how to use these psychedelic experiences. What was new and different, not different, what was new to American culture was we were doing it not to sell you on a religion or a political, or to get you to hate and get you to go to war. We were using it to give you the power to re-imprint yourself and decide how you wanted to run your own life. And that's what got us in trouble, of course.
What I think I wanted to ask you about was, because I'm intrigued about what you said about imprinting in the United States today, CNN using its resources, or the government using its resources to imprint the people. And I'm curious as to what other evidence you see of imprinting that's going on in this culture at this time.
Well, you just using the thing of Michelob beer. You're sitting there, and you're lying in bed, and you're flicking channels, and suddenly there's a Michelob beer ad. And whack, there's a beautiful girl. Hey, there's a bar, there's flashing lights, there's neon, suddenly there's music going. Here's a good-looking guy, they're flirting. Morbi swirling around, bang, bang, bang. The night belongs to Michelob, boom, boom. What you do is you get the brain in a receptive state using trance, music, rhythm, beat, colors. And that's the basis of all shamanic practice, voodoo. Plains Indians used it. You sit around the fireplace and you get the drum going and you dance and you chant and you put yourself into a group situation. And then, it's as they say, it's been used by the mind controllers for thousands of years their message out.
Are we being led around?
Allah is good. Allah is good. Allah is good. Praise Allah. Allah is good. When the Islamic people that run that thing, they get 800 million Islamic people five times a day bowing down, chanting that stuff. Boy, that is powerful. Brain screwing technology that is used to control. And we're trying to get people hip to this so that you can do it. To control yourself, get in charge of your own brain. Don't let the mullahs and the Michelob beer commercial people do it. The Republicans in the last three elections have did that masterfully. They use television. Bush actually had the American voters convinced that the biggest threat to their safety was a black convict named Willie Horton. And look at how they've demonized what the Reagan Bush administration, boogie boogie man, be careful, we're in great danger. The new Hitler's Gaddafi. Yeah, we're gonna bomb Libya. Be careful, careful. We gotta invade Grenada. Be careful, be careful. Noriega. Be careful, boogeyman. Ooh. And now, the wonderful boogeyman Saddam Hussein, this third-rate little dictator over there. The terrible thing about the mind-washing about Hussein, the new Hitler, give me a break. If the Western powers just stop sending arms to Hussein for 1 month, they couldn't make a car, they can't make a gun. It's all German, American, and what else? French, even Swiss were arming the new Hitler. Yeah, the power of these symbols to, that's imprinting. That's the brain gets imprinted with the notion of boogeyman Saddam. If we don't stop him there, he's going to come on Alaska. He'll start with Anchorage, and then he'll take Nome, and then he'll take Juneau, and then he'll come for us. Woo!
And do you think the American public is being led around by their televisions? Led
totally.
Around by the nose?
Totally. By their eyes. Oh, no, the eyes. Mm-hmm.
What's your prognosis, doctor?
Well, I don't do house calls, but and I'm not going to write any prescriptions. The American public right now is going through a real crisis. There is a crisis. It's not in the Gulf. It's in the it's a crisis of courage of the American people. Everything is changing. The factory civilization is over. We can't go back, Ronnie and Nancy, to the old days. We're not going to be a factory. We can't even compete anymore with the Japanese and the Germans. Our politicians are crooks that are have racked up trillions of dollars of looting and stealing in the last 10 years. In the time it takes me to say this sentence, the national debt has gone up $33,000, and now I'll say it again. Now it's $66,000, and I'll say it one more time to round it off to $100,000 that your children are going to have to pay for during that period. The American people know in their hearts when they look in the mirror that we've got to change. We can't go on the old way, but they're spooked, and I have a great deal of compassion. It is tough to realize that we're no longer can just ride on being Americans, and we're going to have to. Nobody wants to change, particularly when the leadership is so dishonest that won't confront the Americans with the real issue. Yeah, have enough war. We're the strongest. We got the biggest guns. Hey, I read a column by that real monster George Will, you know, in Newsweek, and he said, "What would you rather have? A country that can make a Walkman?" Or a country like ours that can have a smart bomb that can write in one little door, you know. The Walkman, excusing the expression, man, is a personal instrument of personal enjoyment. It's the Walkman is not going to. And by the way, the sales of Walkman have made the Japanese, you know, the richest people in the world. This Republican Party right-wing hardliner notion that because we can build the biggest guns and the biggest smart bombs, somehow that's over, George. And by the way, Dan Quayle, I hope you're listening. You're over, too. But that's hard. It's scary. I have great compassion for the American people. I think that the support for the brutal invasion of the Holy Land by American troops is paper thin, and I think that there's going to be a revulsion against what Bush and the military have done. And I think if we don't do it, certainly the Europeans understand it, the Japanese understand it, the way to solve human problems is not to go to war and drop bombs. And fortunately, no politician dares say it, but I have confidence in the American people. If not, well, too bad. The Germans and the Japanese and the Europeans. By the way, I spent a lot of time in Japan three times in the last year, and spent some time in Europe, too. And I want to tell you, there's a great spirit in Europe. Young people are taking over. They're getting together, European Confederation. There's no danger that Germans are ever going to go to war again. Believe me, they've learned their lesson. Their military was discredited. I'm sorry to say this, but the only way we can solve America's problem is we've got to discredit the military. You see, after World War II, the Japanese and the Italians and the Germans, hey, they weren't allowed to make guns, so now they're rich. Italy's doing great. Spain's doing great. There were three winners of World War II, and it's always dangerous to win a war because then your military is going to, you know, ride for the next one. The three winners of World War II, glorious World War II, were Soviet Union, England, and America. Well, the Soviet military has been totally discredited, and they're out of a job, so that leaves America, the American military, and good old Britain. Maggie Thatcher went down there and kicked the asses of Falkland Island, you know, all that. But we've got to get the military out of power and got to really understand that the guns and arms cannot solve problems. And if I sound radical, I'm not. A Republican president for 8 years was Dwight Eisenhower. And when he left and was all over, no more bullshit, he could say what he wanted. He said, the industrial military complex in this country has got to be stopped. That was a Republican general that said that. And boy, if he were around today, he'd be... He's up there shaking his head, and I'm speaking. I'm now channeling. Hey, I've got Ike. Hey, Ike. Yeah, the hero of World War II. What do you want to tell the American people? Oh, yeah. Kick out the industrial military. Okay, but Ike, are you listening? That's General Eisenhower who's telling you that the Bush-Reagan regime racked up $2.7 trillion in war toys, and that's exactly what Ike told us not to do. And they had to use those toys. So they had to invent wars, war on drugs, war on Panama, war in Grenada, and now we got a wonderful war, to use the $2.7 trillion worth of death instruments that, and that's why the American industries, we can't build a car, but we can sure build a smart bomb.
You're listening to Dr. Timothy Leary. He is the author of a number of books. He's written extensively on psychology, on the use of psychedelics, and on philosophy. His most recent book is Flashbacks, published by St. Martin's Press in 1983 and 1990. I do want to ask you about drugs in the 90s. Drugs in the 90s seem to be more related to society's ills than to its potential. We have a lot of heroin, we've got a lot of crack,
ills,
a lot of coke with individual ills.
Cocaine, heroin, and booze are escapist drugs. They're loser's drugs. If you're not doing well in your life, you want to get drunk or tune out or get jazzed up with cocaine. Psychedelic drugs are not escape drugs. They create more problems than questions. My God, if you want easy escape, booze up. Steroids, of course, are the Bush-Reagan drug, too.
Mm-hmm. Your thoughts in the 60s were that psychedelic drugs expanded the mind. These drugs don't. They numb the mind. I'm wondering from you, is there a way we can solve the problem of drugs that numb, alcohol and the rest, and move to what you think of as the time of expansion again? Is that possible within our time?
Well, there are no easy answers to the abuse of drugs. It's obvious that like 80% of all the cocaine used in this country is used by white middle-class people, but nobody knows about it because they're getting along fine. As a matter of fact, they're probably selling more junk bonds and stealing more white-collar crime money. It's the lower classes, the poor, the underprivileged that are visible. The drug problem in the ghetto or among our minority groups will be solved when we solve the problems. So hopelessness in the ghetto, when we get give some hope to black people and to minority group people that there's something they can do about their situation. The Reagan-Bush administrations have totally turned their back on the problems of the inner city and of education. And it's a real failure of, it's almost treasonous what they have done to our underclass. And
are they fighting any kind of war against drugs from your perspective?
Who?
The Bush administration.
Are they fighting? Yeah, well, they are, sure. They're spending, I don't know, they're spending billions of dollars. I don't know what they're doing with it, but they've got the whole army. There's an ominous thing, what they call the drug abuse industry. There's a whole industry out there of people whose lives depend and whose salaries depend upon having a drug problem that you can put people in jail for. Okay, I got to go now.
Okay.
One more question?
Yeah. I want to ask you about your computer business, Futurique.
The main thing that I'm interested in right now is the development of inexpensive new computers. I didn't like the word computer because the computer, the computer is basically an office machine that will help you to use words, process numbers, or filing, that sort of thing. I'm talking about new versions of the Nintendo-type multimedia home image processing equipment. You take a Nintendo-type machine and pop a compact disc in it, and that compact disc could have 40 movies, films from MGM Library. It could have the Encyclopedia Britannica, although you want to do that. And using these inexpensive machines, students in classes will be able to do electronic screen versions of books. So if you're studying chemistry, you'll have a little scene where you're floating down. You're an atom, and you're a hydrogen atom, and another student is a oxygen atom, and we get another oxygen. We'll, H2O will make water. We're going to use our eyes and screens to think and communicate.
Moving all this via the keyboard or a mouse or...
Yeah. The keyboard, by the way, is finished. The keyboard letters is for people that want to do word processing. A new language is developing. It's a global language. And by the way, I should have said this. Nationalism is through. There's a new new spirit sweeping the world of globalism, and a new language is going to develop of, multimedia, graphic, visual, screen language that will allow people to communicate. We'll still use English, and they'll still use Japanese over there, but we'll be able to communicate using this new language. And anything that gets people communicating, getting people understanding each other is the way to a peaceful and prosperous solution. I want to thank you for this very thoughtful, thought-provoking interview, and it's been a pleasure to be here. And
well, thank you, Dr. Leary. You've been listening to Dr. Timothy Leary. I'm Susan McGinnis for KUAC-FM, and this is Conversations. Join us again.